so.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, everybody, for coming out today. It's very exciting to have Congressman Murphy here for his Congress on the Corner. Since 2009, Congressman Murphy's been working hard for us upstate here and has held over 100 of these Congress on the Corners, been to all 137 towns in this district. These congressional districts are huge. But, you know, really, it's just great to be here. He's very open, transparent. He's been working hard down there, which is why he wants to come here and have the opportunity to listen to you all. So I really thank you all for coming out. And Congressman Murphy.
So I want to recognize some of the local elected officials that are here today, just thank them for their service. So I'll just call names if people want to stand up or wave their hand. That'd be great. Gene Hatton from the Town Council in Athens. Thank you. Joe Kozlowski, the Village Trustee in Catskill. Jim Van Slyke from the County Legislature, representing New Baltimore. Patrick Kennedy from the Town Council in Kiksaki. Forrest Cotton. And Forrest, do you have your son still? Yes. He has his Luke Skywalker mitten on, and I was telling Forrest and his son earlier today, we were having breakfast together, that this weekend we had a birthday party at my house. There were 12 5-year-olds. My son was having his birthday party, and it was a Star Wars Jedi Knight theme. And so they all were in Jedi training camp. So they searched out camouflaged eggs that were hidden in the yard, and then they learned lightsaber dueling, and then there was the lightsaber duel obstacle course. And then the grand finale was that I got to wear the Halloween costume of Darth Vader and come with the red lightsabers and try to fight off the 12 young Jedis. But I was unsuccessful. They chopped me into little pieces. So that was my weekend. Anyway, Andrea Smallwood, the mayor of Athens as well. So, as the supervisor said, I'm Scott Murphy. I live in Glens Falls. I shouldn't have trouble with that question. And represent the 20th Congressional District. It's an honor to represent everybody in Greene County and part of 10 other counties, or 10 counties total, that I serve in this district. Most of you know from when I got elected last year, was a special election in March, about a year ago yesterday, actually. Before that, I was a small businessman. Most of my life has been starting businesses and growing businesses all over upstate New York. That's been really my profession, and I'm taking some time out now doing the public service, and very honored to serve on your behalf. And one of the things I promised people I would do is be open and available, post my schedule online, my earmark requests online, let people know what I was working on, and follow what my mother taught me when I was a little kid, which is, if you aren't comfortable with something made on the front page of the newspaper tomorrow, you probably shouldn't be doing it. And I think it's a good rule to live by, and it's the way I try to run the business of representing people in the district. So, as the supervisor said, I've been to all 137 towns now. I didn't get that done in the 7-week special election, but during the course of the first year I did that, and tried to have some kind of public event everywhere. We've done about 100 meetings like this where we're talking about health care and health reform, and we'll talk about that some more here, and I'll save that for last, because I'm guessing there's going to be most questions about that. Tell you a few other things that I've been working on in my year in public service. I serve on the Armed Services Committee and the Agriculture Committee, so those are two areas that I spend extra time, and in particular, I did take a trip recently over to Afghanistan to see what's going on over there. I can give you kind of the quick update on things that we're facing in the armed services world. We are successfully winding down in Iraq, which was one of the big initiatives of President Obama's first year, and I think we've seen the troop reduction there pretty significantly, down by about half the soldiers, and having a pretty successful transition right now in terms of letting the Iraqis take responsibility for their own security and getting our troops home. We've just had an election there, which was, assuming they get a new government, they're kind of trying to form the government now. It will be an amazing hallmark event in that the opposition party appears to have won the election and looks like we're going to see, knock on wood, a peaceful transition of government there, which would be such an incredible change from when Saddam Hussein ran that country. And to see that in Iraq would be, for me, a great success for us, and also a big step towards us being able to get all of our soldiers home from there. My trip to Afghanistan, I was very heartened to to see what I saw there. I met with General McChrystal, who's running the operation now. He's in charge of the Afghanistan theater. Ambassador Eikenberry, who came out of the military and is now the ambassador there, and to see how closely our military personnel and our civilian personnel are working together and how clear their mission is in terms of what they're trying to do to disrupt and deny al-Qaeda the ability to reform their terrorist training camps and do that in a way that allows us to help the Afghan government provide local government so that people don't want to turn to the Taliban or warlords, but to actually have a government that's functioning, and then to hand that over and get out of there. It's training Afghans to do this. It's helping them build up their governmental institutions with a real mission to get us back home. And what I saw was from the generals at the top to the privates and all the foreign partners and the Afghan citizens that I spoke with was real understanding of a very clear mission that we have to be helpful, but also to have a plan to get back out of there and get home, that we are not interested in occupying, we're not interested in running things, but we are trying to help the Afghans get their government up and running in a way that is a better alternative than the Taliban. Some people worry about, you know, development issues. Are we helping them do this and that? I can tell you, having been there firsthand, this is a very, very poor country. There's no paved roads in Kandahar, where I went, which is the second biggest city, or not very few. There's not electricity in most places. There's not water and sewer. I mean, the needs are unbelievable. That's not our issue. We're not trying to solve the needs. We're trying to help the Afghan government be a better alternative than the Taliban. And that's a much lower bar in terms of what you're trying to do, because the Taliban aren't loved based on the people I talk to. They are just an alternative that's out there that had guns and was able to take power. But if we can leave behind an Afghan government that is a better alternative than that, we can get out a lot sooner, and we can be confident that al-Qaeda is not coming back to train there, which is really obviously the reason we're there at all. So that's stuff we're working on the armed forces side and dealing with military issues. And I spend a lot of time working on veterans issues in my office here in the district and in Washington to make sure that we're helping our veterans with GI Bill benefits and being able to get education when they get back, helping people find jobs with our veterans business advisory centers and helping them start businesses, and making sure they get the benefits they're entitled to through the VA system, medical benefits and other benefits that they get as a result of serving in our armed forces. And that's something we're very proud about and have had a lot of success with. So that's the kind of military side and the Armed Services Committee. Also work on a lot of agricultural issues, in particular the last year, a lot of dairy issues. As you know, this is a horrible last year and a half for our dairy industry. Prices really cratered with the recession, and our dairy farmers have been struggling all across the district. So we're involved in a number of issues, trying to get government help to get the market moving again, get the export market moving. There was a one-time payment that was done at the end of last year to try to keep our farmers in business that I was involved in helping with. So I've been very active on dairy issues, and then working with our local farmers, who are some of our best small businessmen and women that are out there. People kind of are amazed. They're like, well, there's, you know, you got small business and you got farmers. And I'm like, I don't meet anybody that's running a farm that's not a good small business person, because if you weren't, you are not in that business anymore. It's been far too hard for the last 30 years to survive. But the farmers in our district and that I deal with are very very talented business people who are facing the same issues other small business people are, with access to capital and trained labor force and some price certainty in terms of their markets where they're trying to go. So spend a lot of time working with our farmers and working on ag issues as well. The biggest focus of all the efforts, so we do a lot of armed services and agricultural issues, but the main focus of what I wanted to go to Washington to work on and what I continue to work on is the economy. And that ties into all of these issues and how do we get jobs going. We did a big summit up in Saratoga with people from all over the district about 2 weeks ago to talk about different things that we can do. I think it's very important that people understand my perspective. I don't believe the government is the solution to creating jobs. The government can help. The government hires people in the short term. We could put some people to work on transportation projects and other things as we go through this crisis. But in the long term, the private sector is where we create wealth. It's where we create jobs. It's where we build businesses. It's what makes the country strong. It's what allows government to do the things that we want to as a society. It's all about growing the private sector and growing that economy. And that comes from our small businesses. Big businesses are great, but they buy small businesses. That's kind of what they do. They don't grow by themselves. If you look at the statistics, the job growth comes from small companies, generally in their first 5 years of life. Two-thirds of the jobs are created by those new small businesses that are dynamic and growing and driving things forward. And so that's where we've got to provide help, and that's where I think the government has a role in this whole thing. So at our Economic Development Summit, I introduced the way we think about economic reform and revitalizing upstate New York, which is four components. The most important piece is helping small businesses, helping them with access to capital. The SBA loan program I spend a lot of time working on, which has really been helpful to a lot of small businesses, helping with tax policy. We just passed some stuff in the House to let small businesses that are startups deduct more of their expenses and to get so where they don't have capital gains on new small businesses that are started this year. So that we're really trying to encourage that behavior. Small businesses and farms, critical. Other places where I see a role for government in terms of economic development, infrastructure, public-private partnerships, but basic infrastructure, broadband internet access, and so much of this district that doesn't have it, water and sewer projects all over this district. I travel around, and almost every town I go to is struggling with water and sewer issues as the old infrastructure that's here needs to grow, or as communities are growing, they've got to expand that. That's a place where it makes sense for me to see governmental investment, and then the private sector flourishes on top of that with broadband internet, with water and sewer available so you can build your businesses. Energy is a place where I think the government has a role. I didn't realize this till I got involved in political life and public service. There are months in the last couple years where our entire trade deficit is imported oil. The whole thing is oil that we're importing. That's a huge problem. It's a problem for us economically. That's why we've got such a huge trade deficit. It's also a problem for us geopolitically. We spend so much time and energy trying to protect those energy supplies around the world. It really impacts our foreign policy and the costs of our foreign policy. So I think energy independence is critical. And part of that is looking at where we can find domestic supplies. It's looking at next generation technology and wind and solar. It's looking at natural gas like we have in the Marcellus Shale. We've got to be able to get to it safely, and that's a concern that a lot of people have, including myself. But at the same time, it's a source we should be surely looking at. Looking at nuclear power as part of a solution for us to have domestic control of our energy needs, incredibly important. And the last area that I think makes sense for government and the private sector to be working together to get the economy moving is education. We can't have successful businesses without a trained workforce. I was over at Duquesne just earlier today, the old Dynabuild, where they're doing airframe manufacturing and talking about the engineering talent they're able to hire because of some of the good engineering schools we have here in the Capital Region and how that's an important competitive advantage for them as they're trying to build their business. There's a real synergy there because education is a role where government does have a place to play, in my opinion, the public school system and driving a talented workforce. I was over at the elementary school, the Athens-Coxsackie Elementary Schools this morning, looking at this very cool smart board technology that they're using in the rooms, and watching a kindergarten class doing exercises on clouds that I am embarrassed to say I did not know the answers to all the questions that these kindergartners were answering about the different kinds of clouds and how they work and where they're formed and what layer of the atmosphere they're in. It was astonishing, and they were totally engaged and excited about this. So there's a role there. It's a tough one this year. Obviously, we're all facing very tough school budgets, and we're facing all kinds of tough budgets at every level of government. But that's an area that I think is critically important. We did some very important reform in the last couple weeks in Washington with respect to higher education to save some money and to make, at the same time, higher education more affordable to people. And I think that was very good reform that I was excited about us doing. So those are the areas that I've been working and want to continue to work in terms of finding that balance between the public sector and the private sector so that our public sector helps with that underlying core infrastructure and the private sector can grow jobs on top of that. Now, healthcare, last issue I'll talk on because I'm sure a lot of people have questions about it. Many of you know I voted against the House healthcare reform bill last fall. How did I make that decision? You know, we started talking about healthcare soon after I got into office about a year ago, and I was not the world's expert on the healthcare system. I've interacted with it. I've been a business owner buying health insurance and seeing the costs go up. I've been a consumer using health insurance and frustrated with certain things in the system. But there was a lot to learn. So I started traveling around talking to people, doing town hall meetings, asking what people wanted to see. Was the system right? Don't change it. Did they want certain changes, other changes? What did people want? It was very clear to me. We got overwhelming agreement from people that people thought we could do better, that the system has some great things about it. We get great care if you've got good insurance, but we have kind of mediocre public health outcomes, and people are very frustrated with the way the system works, and most importantly, frustrated with the spiraling costs that are going up and up and up over time and feel like they're just pinching families and individuals. So that was pretty clear. There was a lot of agreement around that. People really wanted to have control of their healthcare decisions. very personal, very important to people. They didn't want the government or insurance companies or anybody else telling them who their doctors should be. They wanted to pick their doctors, and they wanted they and their doctors to decide what kind of treatment they need and can get, and not have an insurance company say, well, you can't get that. That's not an approved version of the treatment. So that's what I heard from people. Then I sat and talked to experts, met with hundreds of different doctors, private practices, people at hospitals, groups of doctors, nurses, hospital administrators, even talked to insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies to try to understand how the system works and what is all this reform about. At the end of the day, the bill in the House last year, I thought it did a good job of getting more people coverage and did a good job of insurance reforms that were going to give people more power to make more decisions about their own health care. I didn't think it did a particularly good job on controlling costs. I thought that as a result of that bill, we would not see a real change in the trajectory of where costs are going, which has been for the last 20 years, just up and up and up and up and up. So I voted no. I thought we needed to do all those things at once, not just some of them if we were going to do a health care bill. Kept talking to people, kept working on it. Over the fall, learned a lot more about Medicare fraud and abuse. I don't know how many people in the room saw the 60 Minutes story about the drug dealer who switched professions to steal from Medicare because it was easier. So those of you who didn't, it was an unbelievable story. One night I was at my family dinner on a Sunday night. We all get together for dinner watching football, and after that 60 Minutes came on, and it was this guy who had been a drug dealer in Florida who then had switched professions because it was easier to steal from Medicare and was then telling the tricks of the trade. And I watched this, it just made my blood boil. So I actually called the 60 Minutes guy who did the story and said, where'd you get your information? What can we do to fix this? This is, I think, my job. And he told me some people he talked to, so I started calling people at Department of Justice and Health and Human Services at Medicare and Medicaid that run the programs and started going through the problems that we have. And it turns out, all the experts agree, $60 billion to $100 billion a year of waste, fraud, and abuse in the Medicare system. It's unintended consequences. The government used to pay their bills slowly. The healthcare world, doctors and hospitals came and complained to people in Congress like me and said, hey, you guys are paying your bills too slow. We said, well, we'll fix that. I don't know what year this was, but it was many years ago. We'll pay every bill in 30 days. Sounds reasonable. So the bureaucrats say, okay, we've got to pay every bill in 30 days. We'll pay them all in 15 days, so we'll never be late. So they pay every bill in Medicare. They try to pay every bill in 15 days. But guess what? You pay it in 15 days, you don't have time to investigate if it's real. So they just pay them all. Well, the criminals eventually figured this out and started just sending in fake bills. The study, one of the studies that was done, says that 50% of the wheelchairs in the United States were ordered in Dade County, which is Miami, in 1 year. There's 1% of the population, they ordered 50% of the wheelchairs. But Medicare didn't have a tool to stop that. So they found out about it, and they just keep paying the bills. Well, I got involved in working on this, worked with the Senate, worked with the President, the White House's office, on language. We introduced a bill in December with about 20 different things that you could do to start to slow down these ridiculous payments that are going out. We got a lot of it into the Senate bill. We got more of it into the President's amendment. There's a big chunk of meaningful Medicare fraud and abuse reform that was in this package that we voted on in the House. And that's one of the things I'm most proud of being involved in working on, because it just made no sense. There's more to do. We've got more ideas that we're pushing to get passed separately that didn't necessarily make it into this bill, but I think it was a big step forward. So got involved in that, worked on that. What was the difference with the bill that I voted for versus the one that I voted against? The bill that I voted for a week and a half ago, the President's health care bill, fundamentally fiscally responsible. This Congressional Budget Office won't have perfect numbers, but they are the independent group that looks at everything we do in Washington and says, is this going to help or hurt the federal budget? Is it spending or is it cost savings? What is it? How's it going to work? So they're not partisan. They stay around. As I say, they're not perfect, but they say it'll save the federal government $141 billion, $143 billion over the first 10 years. But way more importantly, over the second 10 years, they estimate it'll save the federal government $1.2 trillion. The biggest piece of deficit reduction that we've seen in more than a decade. Moving in the right direction. As I say, that number is not perfect. That's a long-term estimate. But it was clear to me that it was moving in the right direction. I didn't think the House bill was going to be moving in that direction. I thought, if anything, we were going to see costs keep going up. And that's the big difference. How that happens, there's a lot of various reforms in there, and we could talk more about it, but rather than bore you with all of them, I'll tell you a couple other things that I think about the difference between these bills. One is fiscal responsibility for the government. Two is I believe this bill will actually slow the out-of-control growth of healthcare costs. Not make it go, you know, health insurance premiums aren't going to go down 50% next year, but I think they're going to go up slower as a result of the reforms in this package in a way that I didn't think the House bill was doing. It's the same reason that the government's costs go down. It pays for Medicare and Medicaid. I think private insurance costs will also be impacted by these reforms. It's about paying for value instead of volume. That's a huge one. Incentives for people to do wellness things that will actually take care of your own health. I've heard that from every doctor and hospital I talk to. They want the patients more incented with financial incentives to take care of their own health. And an independent commission that actually can take all these pilot programs, the ones that work, and roll them out nationwide. For 30 years, we've had pilot programs to make our medical system more efficient, but then they come back to Congress to get approved, and Congress gets stuck with special interests lobbying them and keeping them from making changes that actually save money. This program will actually take that dynamic and change it and get the special interests out of the way of rolling out things that actually work. So a number of initiatives that I think will work. Critical difference also, how it impacts small businesses. The House bill last fall mandated almost every small business buy health insurance for their employees. That, to me, was a big burden for our small businesses, which, as you've heard me say, are the drivers of our economic growth. The president's bill exempts small businesses up to 50 people, 50 full-time employees, don't have to provide insurance. Instead, there's a carrot, a tax incentive, a tax credit, if you do provide insurance. So we're trying to get them to do it, but not forcing them to. And I think that's a critical difference between the two bills and very important. And we're providing help for small businesses that want to go on an exchange where all the small businesses and individuals in the state can come together and get purchasing power against the insurance company. It's the same thing local chambers of commerce have been doing. Instead of you being a five-person company trying to get a good rate from an insurance company that's got 10 million lives, where, you know, it's David and Goliath, all the companies band together and the insurance companies try to compete to get that business by getting on the exchange. That's what we do with federal employees, and it's been an effective tool at getting people choice and better pricing. So it's the same model that we use for federal employees. One of the other things I like is that members of Congress, and this is important, and hasn't been reported on very much in the national press, who knows why, a lot of people said last summer, we're changing all this health care. Are members of Congress going to be susceptible to this? I've heard this at a lot of town hall meetings. People were nervous about change and wondering how it was going to affect them. The legislation, the president's health care bill, specifically says members of Congress and our staff must, not can, must use the exchange to buy insurance. So we can't use the federal employees plan anymore that we've been on. We actually are forced to move to these new exchanges. Nobody else in this room is forced to. The only people in the country that are forced to are members of Congress and our staff. And I think it's an important statement that we actually think this is going to work and are willing to try it. You don't have to, but if you want to, you can. But we're going to do it to show that it's something that we believe is actually going to work. That's, I think, really important for people to understand. And I'm subject to that, so my health insurance will have to change when the exchanges come online a couple years from now. And I think it's an important part of putting your money where your mouth is, being open and transparent, and listening to people. Because I heard this concern from a lot of people. They're like, oh, this may affect me, but it won't affect you. And why are you changing my health insurance, my health care world, if you're not doing your own? And so what we actually did was responded to that and said, we will lead by example. Instead of just saying you have to do it, actually do it ourselves. And I think that's an important thing for people to understand. So those are the changes that I think actually make a lot of sense for small businesses, holding down costs for our families and businesses, holding down costs for the federal government, working on Medicare fraud. All that's different from the bill last year. And I think, on balance, a lot better. And so, is it perfect? Absolutely not. Was it something that I wanted to read before I voted on it? Answer this one. I'm sure someone will ask, why did you wait till 2 days before the vote to tell us how you were going to vote? I say very clearly, well, I was actually reading the legislation. So I read the entire Senate bill, which is 2,000-plus pages, and the president's amendments to the bill, which was 150 pages, before I made up my mind, because to me, I could tell you what we wanted. We want more control. Everybody get access. We wanted cost to be contained. But I can't tell you if I think it's going to work until the legislation is actually written. And so for me, I'm amazed that 350 members knew how they were going to vote before they saw the law, because I think the details really matter. That's how I approach things as a small business person. That's how I approach things when solving problems, building businesses. And that's how I approach things in Congress. So anyway, that's a little bit about healthcare, maybe more than you wanted. I didn't even get into what impacts you in the short term. Closing the donut hole starts this year for our seniors. Kids can stay on family plans until they're 26. That starts this year, which hopefully is helpful for a lot of kids coming out of high school and college that haven't found a full-time job in this economy. And kids with pre-existing conditions can't be denied coverage, which is very helpful for young people that do have a disorder disease. And then lifetime and annual caps go away on insurance plans. Those aren't allowed anymore, which was one of the things I never understood in the insurance business. I understand why they like it, but if I get sick, that's when my insurance is supposed to help, not go away when I get sick. And that's something that was very frustrating to people and one of the things that's getting changed in the legislation. And having an independent arbiter that you can go to when you're having a battle with your insurance company and they say you don't need this treatment, your doctor says you do, having an independent arbiter that you can go to. You don't have to sue and go to court, but you can go to an arbiter and get an answer to that. So those are some of the things that change in the first year or so. And then a lot of other things phase in over time. Happy to try to address more of those as people have questions. So that was a long 5-minute introduction, but a lot of stuff going on in Congress, and I apologize if I bored anyone, but hopefully that was somewhat informative. And with that, let's get to your questions, local issues, concerns, or questions about what's going on in Washington. We'll try to form a line over here. Try to form a line over here. We have the big X so I can tell where it is, and I forgot. Thank you.
Ken Baldwin from Athens.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Questions I have are, being as that Obama promised transparency in this whole process and delivered none of it, being as how 75% of the national public wanted this bill defeated, being as how only 45 million people supposedly are without health care, why do we want to change the whole health care for everybody in the whole nation rather than just work on those 30 to 45 million people that supposedly don't have it? And I guess the next question would be, are you planning on voting for his other initiatives, like giving 4 million federal convicted felons the right to vote, given the 11 to 25 million illegal aliens the right to vote, passing cap and trade, which will quadruple our energy costs, and we need to open up all this. There's oil all over this nation. We shouldn't need to import any, but it's all the property is owned by the federal government, which is illegal. I feel it's unconstitutional to have this national health care plan. It will only be constitutional for the New York, for the states to have their health care plan. And being that Social Security is failing, Medicare and Medicaid has failed, Amtrak has failed, United States Post Office has failed, all these agencies that the federal government has ever controlled have failed. Why would anybody think this would work? The only one that passed was the Panama Canal Zone, and they gave that away to the Panama.
So a host of questions in there. I don't know that I'll get them all. Let me say that I think I understand your point very clearly, that there are some people that don't have insurance today, and how much do we want to change the whole system to solve that problem? I think that that's one of the things I was looking at in this bill in particular. There's a lot of people, talking heads on television, that will tell you this bill is the greatest thing in the history of the world, this bill is the worst thing in the history of the world, everything is going to change, everything is going to be magically better or magically a disaster overnight. I don't believe that's true. I think that this bill makes some changes, some important changes, but it's moving things around the edges as opposed to throwing out the whole system. Almost everybody is going to have the same health insurance they do today that they had 2 weeks ago. Right, it phases in some changes over time. The big thing that we're really trying to solve, I think, the biggest driver in this equation is we've got 30 million plus people who use the emergency room as their primary care doctor. That they don't have any doctors, and they don't have insurance, and they end up using the emergency room as a way to get care. Federal government passed a law in the 80s, 1986, that emergency rooms must take care of people, whether they can pay or not. They can't ask that question. They can't check to see if they have insurance. about half, based on the studies I've seen, of emergency room care doesn't get reimbursed. So they have to shift all of those costs over to the people who are paying for insurance. So from my perspective, we are right now, all of us that buy insurance are paying for the people to get the care in the emergency rooms that don't pay for it and don't have insurance. But as a result of this, where we're pushing people to have insurance, helping them if they can't afford it, but pushing everybody to have their own insurance, we're actually making it much fairer on the people who are paying that burden right now, which is all of the people with private insurance that are covering that cost. So that's the problem I think we're solving. You know, I hear a lot the question of, is it constitutional to have a federal health insurance plan or mandate? There's not really a federal plan per se that people would sign up for. The states are running the exchanges, but there is a federal requirement that people have health insurance. And I believe that it is constitutional under the Interstate Commerce Clause, which is how a lot of things are regulated that have to do with commerce and transactions all over the country. But I understand that. I guess for me, you know, Medicare and Social Security, dramatically more intrusive. This says you're required to have this or you pay a penalty, but you basically buy in the private sector and you get the insurance you want, whereas Social Security and Medicare, actually, people are required to pay into whether they want to or not. So for me, this is not nearly as big a step. This is much more of a public-private partnership. Get private insurance, we'll have some public help so you can afford it, and it's trying to solve this problem of people who don't have insurance that use the emergency rooms, and we all pay for anyway. So that's part of what we're trying to do or what's trying to be done here, and that made sense to me logically. We could go back and say our emergency rooms are not going to take care of people. If they show up in a car wreck, if they don't have money or an insurance card, we won't take care of you. And I talk about that, and some people say, hey, it should be more Darwinian like that. I'm not comfortable with going there. So now, you know, if we're going to continue to provide care, it's a question of how you pay for it. And I think this is a better way than right now everybody else paying for it. But there are honest disagreements about that. So I appreciate you being here. And I will also tell you, you listed a whole host of Obama's other initiatives. I will agree with some of them. I will disagree with some of them because I'm going to look at each one. So the cap and trade bill was passed in the House last summer. I did vote for it. It's gone to the Senate. Something different will come back. It'll be a very different bill than what we saw last summer. This is why I thought it was good for upstate New York. New York cleaned up our power many years ago. We have 10% or less coal. We have very low emissions. We have hydro and nuclear and natural gas, renewables. We have very, very high energy costs relative to other places. The places that have cheap coal, some of them, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Missouri, they have 6 cents per kilowatt hour power. We have 17 cent power here. It is an unfair playing field for our businesses right now. I saw this with every one of my companies. With the legislation we passed last summer, it would be much more fair because they would have to do the same kind of cleaning up we would. It would be a competitive advantage for New York versus other places. And I'll give you my source. The Heritage Foundation, very conservative think tank, put out a report right around the time of the vote, a few days before, saying this is how it's going to impact your state. There were five states or six states that they said will win as a result of the cap and trade policy, and 44 states they were arguing would lose. New York was one of the winners. That was because we've already done the work that's required under that legislation, but now everybody else has to, and we gain competitively versus some of our competitors. So that was my thinking on that. Sorry, Adam.
Hello, Carl. Joe Cardinale.
Good to see you. Thanks for being here.
I was disappointed in your yes vote, okay? And I hear your statement that you guys are going to have to participate in the same co-ops or whatever you want to refer to them as, exchanges. The question is, I'm real concerned that this bill, like all those other government bills that you talked about passing that messed up our health care, is going to greatly increase my costs. Who's going to be paying your bill in the exchange, you or me, the taxpayer?
Sure. Thanks, Joe. Appreciate your comments. So my health insurance works like many people who work for large organizations. I work for a large organization now, you, but also the federal government, depending on how you want to call it. Right now, I think it's about three quarters is paid for by my employer and about one quarter by me. I don't know the exact numbers, but last time I looked, I had these numbers in my head when I was talking about this. In December, I think my health insurance premium was like $350 that came out of my check. And I have a Blue Cross Blue Shield PPO kind of plan. So there's doctors in the network and doctors out of the network, and you pay different amounts if you want to go to somebody who's not in the network. Have a copay, $20 when I went to the doctor. Have a deductible, you know, this is all basic, same stuff that everybody else has, but it's subsidized by my employer. They're paying more than half of it, and I'm paying the other piece. That I assume would be about the same in the exchange. I have a similar deal to most other federal employees, and a lot of people that work for companies that provide insurance. Often the company's paying for, you know, 50%, 75%, 100% of it, and you're paying the rest of the premium, and then you have copays and deductibles. So it's pretty parallel. It's not this special plan that my grandmother keeps saying she read about on the internet and tells me that I have. She calls me every month or so and tells me that she's read about something else she didn't know about my new job. The first month I was in office, she called and said, "Well, you're set for life, honey, aren't you?" And I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "Well, I just read that you get your salary, once you serve one day, you get your salary for the rest of your life." And I said, "Well, where'd you read that?" She said, "Well, a friend of mine sent me an email, and it said that, and so I'm excited for you." And I said, "Well, that's not true." And she said, "Well, I read it in this email, so I know that it's true." And I said, "Well, I met with the benefits person last week when I had to fill out my health insurance forms and ask about pensions and do I want to contribute to the 401k. It's not called a 401k. It has some different name, but same idea. And that's not how it works." And she took me a while to convince her, but the way the federal plan works for members of Congress is if I work 30 years, which I can promise you I'm not going to do this job for 30 years. I would be far too tired, and I can't imagine that would work out. But if I did it for 30 years, then I would get 44% of my salary when I retire, which is a nice pension plan, but it's not 100% after the first day. It's a far cry. If you work less than 5 years, you don't vest, and you get nothing from that pension plan. Separately, I can do like a 401k. I can contribute some money into a tax-deferred kind of thing. Anyway,
in the health care, though.
I'm sorry. One of my favorite stories to get
in that part, are all the federal employees going to be paying part of their own bill, a significant part of their own bill? Or is the taxpayer going to be paying? Because if that price goes through the roof, who cares if the government's paying for it? Just not.
Yeah, so I don't know about every federal employee and how all of it works, but I believe they're roughly on that same kind of thing where the government pays a portion and they pay a portion. So there is some sensitivity to cost. But I think the important thing is trying to look at big picture costs in our system. Things that we kind of all the experts know drive costs up in our system. One, medical malpractice stuff. We did a very minor amount of tort reform in this bill. Some of it's fine. I like what we did. We didn't do enough. So we could do more there. But value pricing instead of volume pricing, a huge issue, like tort reform. Then I'll tell you this little story. In Boston, the allergy doctors and people dealing with asthma a couple years ago came together and said, we can do better for the kids. There's a lot of kids that end up in the hospital with severe cases of allergies or asthma. We can send out nurses and technicians, go to their house, help them figure out ways to avoid getting sick. We can do things that will reduce the dust in their house, teach them tricks that will help them stay out of the hospital. Doctors did this. They ran a big program in Boston. It worked great. At the end of the first year, the doctors sat down and looked at it. They said, we have cut hospital admissions by 80%. Huge success. And we're about to go out of business. We can't pay our people. We can't pay ourselves because our system right now pays them to see people in the hospital, pays them to run tests on people in the hospital, pays them to run procedures and visits. If they actually keep their patients well, they can't make a living. So they went to the insurance companies and to the hospitals and said, we've got to rejigger this payment model because it's broken. And we could either stop keeping people out of the hospital, stop helping kids stay home and healthy, or we could go out of business. Those are not good options. We want to keep the kids healthy, but we also want to get paid to do our work. So they're working on that. That's an idea. That's moving away from volume and to value. That's where our system is another way that our system's broken. This bill actually has a dozen pilot programs that are trying to work on that very idea of moving towards quality and towards value payment instead of volume. And I referenced earlier the independent commission that can roll out those things nationwide when they see that they work. That's how we get that thing from Boston that they're working out all over the country and save millions and millions of dollars in hospital admissions for kids, have healthier kids, save money. But right now the system doesn't do that. It drives us in the wrong direction. So I really believe that the reforms in here are going to move us in the right direction on cost. I could be wrong. Obviously, it's all projections, but I really have talked to the experts and studied this stuff. Should we do tort reform? Yes. There are other things that we should do, but that doesn't mean the things that were tried aren't going in the right direction. Our system spends so much money that there's so many things we can do to move in the
right
direction.
So that'll shut down hospitals then or reduce the cost?
We have a lot of questions.
It should help reduce the cost for them. And then obviously you've got to balance all those things. Sorry, it's kind of warm here. Can we try to...
Let's open that door. Can we do something?
Or maybe it's just me.
Here's the questions.
Okay, let's do this.
My name is Harriet Hennessy, and I'm from Casca. I'm here on behalf of my granddaughter. Brooklyn Ray. She has spinal muscular atrophy. SMA is the number one genetic killer in children. 1 in 6,000 are born with SMA. 1 in 40 of us are carriers of a genetic a gene that causes this. When two carriers get together, 1 in 4 chance that they have an SMA baby. There's no cure, and it shortens their lifespan. And my main reason for the families of SMA is to ask you to kindly co-sponsor the Treatment of Acceleration Act of 2009, H.R. 2149 and S. 1150, and I apologize for being so nervous.
Okay, thank you.
I have more information.
Okay, we'll take a look at it and see, and thank you for sharing. And one of the things that this healthcare bill does do that I think is good is immediately starts making it so that kids who don't have insurance that do find out that they're sick can actually get insurance. And I think that's an important thing for our
communities.
They have
insurance, but families of SMA need help to fund research. April 27th, there's a meeting at Capitol Hill with Congress and with researchers and families of SMA to talk to you about.
And hopefully you'll come by and see me when you're in town in Washington.
I just came from Florida where my granddaughter is.
Okay.
So financially, I can't come down, but there will be
the other families.
There.
Great. Thank you.
Ed Thompson's Athens. One of my primary concerns right now is my wife and I are retired. We've worked all our lives, paid taxes all our lives, continually get them raised. We're now in our mid-70s, and now our health costs this January 1st went up 39%, and they're going up all over the country.
Through Medicare or?
Our HMO coverage. Now, my question is, do you and Congress and the rest of the Senate and the rest of them down there have any idea of how to curtail these insurance companies from continually raising the premium with no way of stopping it? I think in California, it's 50% raises in some of them. Now, this is kind of ridiculous. Now, I hate to say this, but most Americans for the last 10 years have finally gotten fed up with Congress, the Senate, and now our local New York State government because they're doing nothing and then nothing's getting accomplished. So this health reform bill, even though most of us don't have a clue about what's in it because nothing was ever explained to us before this, at least it got passed so that something that the Congress has established. But these constant raises to the seniors, and we seem to be the forgotten people in the United States, the seniors. The Social Security, no raises. They keep raising our taxes. They keep raising the cost of Medicare. So my question to you is there any way of you stopping these continually spiraling health care costs?
Thank you. Thanks for being here. Thanks for your question. So there's two things that go into insurance costs, and there's two ways to attack it. One is, what are they paying for the health care that you're getting? So there's the cost of the health care. Two is their overhead and profits. And so there's both sides of that. So we were talking earlier about trying to do things to make the system more efficient and take cost out of what it takes to take care of people. So that's one thing that we are doing that should help with premiums. The other side is the insurance companies. Is it just profits and overhead that they're running up? So this legislation actually takes a big step in that direction. It says that insurance companies have to take 85% of what they're getting in premiums and actually use that to pay for care. So the overhead can only be 15%, and their profits have to come out of that. So they can't make that any bigger. That's one of the rules that was done. I think it was a big step forward in terms of trying to push insurance companies to be competitive. But the bigger piece of it, 85% of their money is going for the cost of care. We've got to do reform over there. We did look at, and I wish we had gotten done prior rate review, something that I've heard a lot about from people, which is that there would be an insurance department or someone else would review rate increases each year before they go into effect. We used to have that in New York. We got rid of it. We tried to get this into legislation at the federal level. It didn't get done. So 20-some states have it. We don't have it in New York, and that didn't happen in the reform. But I think that what's called the medical loss ratio, the 85% has to go for claims, will be a big help to people in terms of keeping down those insurance raises.
I'm Donna Williams from Mathley. Thank you first for being such a supporter of small businesses and agriculture, and that's where my questions are headed. Local farmers, local businesses, local food is really important, particularly in Greene County, for our economic well-being, lifestyle, and health. And there's a lot of initiatives going on at local, county, regional, state levels. I really wonder, though, if we need to be looking at federal regulations, federal subsidies. Are they hurting our small farmers to the benefit of the larger industrial food producers? And are there regulations that are really hurting our small food businesses, our small farmers, that are really designed to protect us from these large processors' issues, you know, salmonella, and issues like that? Well, that's it.
Okay. Thank you. No, the local producers and local food is an important issue, and we hear about it a lot. We're having a conference that we're actually working on here in the next month or so with a number of local food producers, the small farmers, and working on this issue. The big issue that's been on this front at the federal level has really been the food safety bill. As a result of some of the outbreaks over the last few years, it's been a big push for food safety. But, you know, if you do that wrong, it can be a huge problem for our small farmers, because a lot of the rules, the big farms may be able to have an inspector that travels around inspecting. It's a very different thing with some of the farmers I have that might grow 40 or 50 different crops on 50 acres. And, you know, it's all different processes. So we've been trying to find that right balance, because we want safe food coming from all of our farmers, big or small, but we're trying to figure out ways to deal with that regulatorily, keeping in mind our small farmers. So that's something we've been working on in Congress. And as the Farm Bill comes up for reallocation in about 2 years, we'll be looking again at that balance of payments to large farms versus small farms. There are caps on most programs so that the very large farmers don't qualify for them, but there are some ways that they find around it, and there's some things that we need to close down.
Vince Catini from Quixote, right up the road here. The reason I'm here is I'd like to know, as our representative in the 20th District, it's like a community. You're a leader. And yet, 56 or 55% of us did not want you to vote for this health care bill, and you did. You went against our wishes as a community. Number one, why did you do that? And number two, in this health care bill, I'm very concerned about rationing. I have friends from Canada that call me and say, what are you, nuts? We're trying to get away from what you're trying to go to. And being a person that had to make some major decisions in my family of who lives and who dies, I want to make that decision, not some bureaucrat. Can you help me with that?
Thank you. I'll answer the last question first, Vince, in terms of rationing. So there was a lot of talk about rationing all summer. This became one of the things that you heard on television all the time. Everybody talking about rationing. The government's going to decide who gets what care, when, and how. And there was a ton of talk around it. That was not something that I ever found in the bill. I read the House bill last summer. I read the Senate bill. This is private insurance. People are buying private insurance. They're paying for it themselves. If they need help, they're getting help from a subsidy. Through an exchange concept, they negotiate with their private insurance companies what's covered and what's not covered. In fact, there's an arbiter you can go to if you and your doctor think it's medically necessary and your insurance company says no. So I don't believe that that's fundamentally the issue that we're facing. There's not a board being set up to make these decisions, even though people will tell you that. Well, anything could happen in the future. Anything could happen in the future, absolutely. Some people say it's rationing by there won't be access to coverage. I guess that's possible. I don't see that as the results that we're talking about. That's not the path that I think it's headed down. I wouldn't be in favor of that. Canada runs a different system. We spend a lot more money on our healthcare system than any other industrialized country, which is why people are able to get a lot more care here. Could we do it more efficiently? I believe we can. I think this is a step towards doing it more efficiently. But this is not getting rid of private insurance. It's not putting everybody on a single-payer government system, the things that I think most people really worry lead to some kind of rationing. So I just don't think that's the direction that this is headed in. People can disagree with me, but I did spend the time to look at it and think about it, and I am very aware of that concern, and I just didn't think that's where this is necessarily headed. So, you asked something else, and I forgot.
Why did you vote against the...
Why did I vote against the... There is nobody that knows what the people in the district think in the aggregate. So what I did was spent time traveling around talking to people. We took
a survey here that says 55%
from
Who's for healthcare?
Here's the question line. If you want to put a question in, please stand in the line.
So here's what I think my job is to listen to the people in the district, understand what they think. It's not to have a poll on every single question and say 50.1 this, 49.9 that, but to understand the issues that they're concerned about, and then to take the time to develop whatever expertise I can, and to carefully read the legislation and evaluate it, and then make a decision based on what I heard from people they want and what I think the outcomes will be. That's why you have me as a representative as opposed to just a straight, we vote on everything. I voted on 1,000 things this year. We couldn't have... You know, that's just the process. But here's what I did get. We had 20,000 calls and emails to my office over the last 2 weeks before the vote. That was from in the district. We had that many, probably more, from outside the district. But the people that came in the district, we recorded them, put them in a database, almost exactly 50-50. It was astonishing. I don't think you could have set it up to be this way if you had tried to orchestrate 10,000 people calling in, which to me gave me what I knew from talking to people. Wide support for some kind of reform, more control, insurance reform, getting everybody coverage, support for that, wide disagreement about the specifics of how to do it. And that's what I took into both the House vote when I looked at it and decided I didn't think it was going to do what we wanted here in the 20th District, and the vote on the President's bill where I thought it was going to move us in the right direction. Not a simple decision, not a, oh my gosh, this is definitely the right way to go, but I thought on balance, more good than harm, and that's how I made that decision.
My name is Joe Mazzolo. I'm a resident of Queens, and came here, And actually, I'm still going to ask that question, but just to continue on that line, I'm a nurse in the emergency room in White Plains Hospital.
Okay. It's a long drive.
It's a long drive. It takes me 2 hours to get there, but I go there 3 days a week. And I agree that something needs to be done. But what is being done is still not going to help the elderly, and still not going to help the handicapped, and still not going to help the disabled veterans. The problem with the system is I see come into my emergency room more than 50% of the people who come in are illegal aliens, and we're and they're sucking up our tax dollars and our medical dollars, and this bill is not going to stop that, no matter what you say or what Obama says. It's not going to stop it. So the question is, really, the truth of the problem with the health care is illegals and lawyers.
Absolutely.
Lawyers suck us dry because they're suing the crap out of our doctors, and illegals are sucking us dry. So, I mean, that's really the problem. And with all the stuff that they addressed, they didn't address the two most important issues. So, that's not my question. But my question actually is, we just heard that the president is like all in favor of drilling for oil now. Now, what was it? Even though he mocked John McCain, he mocked Sarah Palin, he mocked George Bush, he mocked everybody who was in favor of drilling for oil. Now it's important to drill for oil to help our dependence on foreign oil. I'm going to just say this. There's only one way to help our dependence on foreign oil, and that is by allowing us to build refineries here, because we could drill all the oil we want. We keep sending it to Venezuela and other countries who have no pollution control to refine our fuel, and I find it hypocritical. Oh, we don't mess up our environment, but we let them screw up theirs, and then we'll suck up the gas. You know, it's wrong. We should build refineries in this country And instead of drilling off of Florida, where he's talking in the Gulf, how about the Anwar, where there is one well in particular that has enough to supply the country for 225 years at the current rate all by itself? And yet, we're right now, because 4 months ago, Russia and China purchased rental rights for drilling off the coast of Cuba, 90 miles away from the United States of America. They're going to be sucking up our oil. And I got a problem with that. I got a problem with that. And the president isn't addressing the energy issues that really need to be addressed. And I'm asking you, as our congressman, to look into those things. And, you know, that health care issue you can deal with as well.
Thank you. Thanks for coming. So I think you hit on something that is very frustrating for us, and I think we should be permitting refineries in this country. We should try to do them cleanly as we can, with the most modern technology that we can to do that, but we have to think about being energy independent. I think it's one of these battles. Politicians follow the public on this kind of stuff. To your point, the gentleman who was sitting next to you about what do people want, everybody wants clean energy, everybody still uses gasoline, but if you go around and ask, do you want a refinery in your neighborhood, nobody wants it in their neighborhood. That's the dynamic that you have, right? People kind of want it to be somewhere else. And to your point, maybe we put it in some other country where they don't even worry about it being as clean as it can be. They just do whatever's cheap. And that's not a good policy. We need to step up and try to do the right thing, find good locations for these things, and actually move forward and be energy independent. I don't know if I mentioned it here. I'm sorry. I've had three or four meetings today, and so sometimes I say the same things and sometimes I skip pieces, but I think that we should be looking at exploring natural gas. That's something here in our community. Again, we need to do it safely. The Marcellus Shale, we've got to be careful. We don't want to do it the way they would in Texas. We want to be a little more cautious and thoughtful, I think, the way that we are in New York. But I think that we should be looking at that. I think that we should be looking at nuclear power as part of the solution for domestic supplies. Your point about immigration and illegal immigrants is absolutely right on. We've got a huge problem in this country. Everybody's got a different number, 8-10 million people that are here illegally. We need to solve that problem. We need to come up with an immigration reform solution. We need to get over this. We need to get people into the system, paying their bills, doing what they need to do, and we need to solve the problem. It's been punted down the road forever. We had, a few years ago, you had George Bush and Ted Kennedy come together with a solution for immigration reform, but we still couldn't get the willpower to get it done in Congress. I think it's irresponsible that we don't solve the problem. We've got these people here. We've got to get them into the tax system or get them home, get to a solution that solves this problem and not just punt it down the road, because it does impact other things. I think there's more in our healthcare system than just that, but it's one of the drivers that needs to get fixed, and we need to do it. So.
Hi, I'm Joe Carroll from Catskill.
Good to see you.
Hi. I can't understand why people love the insurance companies more than they love their government. Because I just received this letter. I received this letter that said they wanted my marriage certificate after I've been with them for since 68. And they want my tax returns, my marriage certificate, and my wife's and her identification, her driver's license. And if I don't give it to them and look at the big black print, it says your response is needed by this above deadline. If we do not receive your response by this date, all defendants covered under the district's plans as of June 1st will be terminated retroactively after you pay them. And you may be subject to other disciplinary actions. I called him up and said, how are you going to discipline me? What are you going to do, spank me? I don't think it's funny. So, if you can't love your insurance company more than you love your government. I'm sorry. Something has been bothering me for a long time, because I lived during the Depression. I was born in 1928. I saw the people on the bread lines and the soup kitchens and people dispossessed where they throw your furniture out. And all of a sudden the war came, and all of a sudden we had jobs all over the place. I mean, where did they get the money? And after the war, I was under the GI Bill. And not only that, but they bailed out Europe. And Europe was, they rebuilt Europe. Where did they get the money? I don't know. I really don't know. And I wonder if what's happening today, if we're going to be stuck with the bill. Because I really don't know. I really don't think so. Maybe you can help me out. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Well, I think you expressed something that I hear very consistently as people are frustrated with their insurance companies. And I think one of the best things that we did with this reform package was start to take power away from insurance companies and give it back to people and their doctors. And I think that's a good step forward. I won't tell you that I am an expert on budgeting in 1938 and 39 and 40, so I don't think I can answer the question of where the money came from all those initiatives, but it's something to keep in mind as we think about how we go forward. But, there were war bonds and a whole host of things, but I'm just not an expert on that, so I can't really answer that question.
To buy a war bond.
Yes, so I just can't tell you the answer.
My name is Mark Spino. I'm from Coxsackie. With this health care reform, as you know, New York State's in a serious budget problem. Local schools, they're not getting money. All this is happening. Yet, of the 30 million people who don't have insurance or so, whatever the number is, about a third of them are going to be put on Medicaid and Medicare. Well, that's going to raise my taxes to pay for them anyway. So we're paying one way or other. Why do my taxes have to be raised here? To put all these people in. Well, we're already going to be paying more taxes here in New York, and I thought that should have been a major concern for somebody who's representing people in New York.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thanks for your question. That's a very good question, and it is a major concern. So here's actually how it works for New York. New York has, for many, many years, had a lot more people on Medicaid and eligible for Medicaid than most other places in the country. We've had one of the most generous Medicaid programs in the country in terms of who was covered. So the incremental people that are being added in New York is almost no one, because all the people nationwide, a lot more people are eligible for Medicaid, but almost all those people in New York were already eligible and are already on Medicaid because we had set our standards such that so many more people were on here. So what New York gets is over time, and this was a big change in the bill from in the near past, the president changed this. This was kind of related to the Cornhusker kickback, where Nebraska was going to get money to help pay for people on Medicaid, these new people that were being added. New York wasn't under the bill in the Senate. The president changed that in his amendments to this package so that over time it phases in, but New York gets more money for those people that would be new if we hadn't been already covering them here. I'm maybe not being so simple, but used to be had to cover everybody. New York was above that. Now they raised that bar, but what we're doing is at a federal level paying. It rolls in over 7 years, but eventually paying 90% of the cost of those new people with federal dollars. That will actually help New York, because right now New York is paying more than 10% and already covering all those people, almost all of them. So actually, this will help New York because we were already being generous, what was called being a do-gooder state, trying to help more people get insurance. This, when it phases in, the federal government will be helping more with that than they are currently. And there's not a lot of new people being added because we already had them on the rolls, which was an important consideration for me because Medicaid costs actually hit our counties because the counties kick in for them. So I think net-net, New York wins under this because we were already paying for this stuff. Now the rest of the country is. But for us, the federal government's helping more than it was before. Sorry if that was long, but it's a complex issue.
Hi. Thanks for being here.
Joe Maurer, Earlton, New York. This health care bill has already cost me money. My insurance company, in anticipation of me passing this bill, has raised my rate 50%. My copay to the doctor has gone up 300%. My copay to a specialist has gone up 250%. So before this bill even got enacted, my insurance company, CDPHP, has cost me money. Now, us older people on a limited income, it's hurting us. I don't know that the rate will ever go down. I don't know that it'll ever stay the same. Already it cost us money.
Thanks for coming, Joe. So insurance companies have been raising premiums every year for the last 20 years. They may have raised premiums this year, but I don't believe that's because of talking about healthcare reform. They may say that, but they've been raising premiums all over the country before this was passed. They raised them last year. All the projections are they were going to keep raising them. So I don't think it's causally related. I think that it's something that's going on, and I think this legislation will actually help keep them from going up as much in the future. That's my judgment on it based on looking at it. So thanks for coming.
Hi.
Tell me your name and where you're from.
I'm Evan Zager from West Oxaki, and I just have a question. Where in the Constitution does it say that you can, the federal government can force you to buy something?
Thanks, Evan.
So the Constitution says that the federal government has the power to regulate interstate commerce. And that's the judgment and the basis for federal government making rules about things in the economy that are done through interstate commerce. So right now, the federal government says to people that you must participate in Social Security and Medicare, that people have to pay in as a portion of their wages into that, which is not buying a product, but it's actually participating in a product-like thing that the government runs for people. So it's something that's been done for a long time. Doesn't mean that people are excited about it, but that's the basis of the thinking around government things, government ideas like this. And so that's the healthcare legislation says that you have to have health insurance. We as a society have decided we will take care of you if you show up at a hospital, and somebody has to pay for that. We can either pay for it with tax dollars, or we can say you should have insurance to help pay those bills when you show up at the hospital. So there are different ways to solve that problem, or we could say we aren't going to take care of people when they show up at a hospital sick. But those are the kinds of tough decisions governments make. And this is the solution that people came up with. And I'm glad you're here debating it, and we'll keep debating it. And the beauty of our system is that this is what makes America strong, is people coming out to be involved in their government and being involved in elections and expressing their opinions. So thank you for being here, and thanks for getting involved.
And you're more than late, but you have time for one more question.
Hi, Pat.
Hi, Pat.
I'm Pat from Catskill. A change of pace question. What do you think the prospects are for restoring some of McCain-Feingold to the law of the land, and the possibility of having a bipartisan effort in that regard? Campaign finance reform. Thank you.
So the question is campaign finance reform. McCain-Feingold was a big rule that was passed. John McCain and Senator Russ Feingold were co-sponsors of it. The Supreme Court ruled recently that... that corporations and other special interest groups and unions basically have a right to free speech, just like an individual does. And part of that right is the ability to spend as much money as they want to influence elections. It's a big change from where a lot of our policy has been for a long time, that said corporations and special interest groups couldn't spend money directly on political campaigns. I think it's a bad thing for our democracy. I think it's going to be problematic for large special interest groups to be on TV buying television ads about particular campaigns and candidates. I think it's going to be detrimental to our democracy. I think this is the way that we should be communicating with candidates, spending time and hearing how they think and solve problems and making decisions. That said, that was passed by the Supreme Court as their interpretation of the Constitution, so it's not easy to change. There are nuances around disclosure that people are working on changing to make it so if you run that ad, you have to put your name and who you actually are. You can't put a fake name of some shell corporation up, but actually who's doing it, to at least make it come clean on what you're advertising about. So there are things that we're working on, but it is it's a big step in my perspective in the wrong direction. Fundamentally, I think that we need campaign finance reform. I think that the money in politics and the interest groups that support the political process, there's way too much money in the system, and it's a problem, but it's the way the system works right now. I've supported the Fair Elections Now Act, which is something that I think would move us forward, and I'm a co-sponsor of that, and I'm hopeful that we'll have some bipartisan progress on that. We have bipartisan support for it, but it's not something that's got a majority support now, and it's even harder to get done in the Senate. So.
Now, Congressman, this man says this question is 40 seconds long, and you can time him.
Yeah, it's my answer that's not 40 seconds long. That's always the problem.
Thank you very much. My name is Jim Hughes. I'm from Catskill. Thanks for the opportunity. I have a comment more than a question. Spending is out of control in this nation. It's like a freight train screaming down the tracks, throttle wide open, 100 miles an hour, coming to a bridge with a 20-mile-an-hour speed limit. It's okay to say no to some of the initiatives, some of the legislation. But in my opinion, the only people that you're saying no to are the people who are paying the bills.
I absolutely agree with you. I think that federal budget is a real problem and something we've got to get our hands around. I think that we have done a number of things in the last year that I feel good about. There were two things I was pushing for very hard in my first year in Congress that have now been implemented. One is what's called pay-as-you-go rules.
These rules say in Congress, if you want to add spending here, you've got to either come up with a tax to pay for it, or you've got to find something else to cut to balance it out. So you can't just add new things during the course of the year without paying for them. These were the rules that were put in place and ran in the 1990s. We had Democrats and Republicans in Congress, Democrats and Republicans in the White House, but at the end of the 1990s, with these kind of rules, we had balanced budgets. It was only 10 years ago we had balanced budgets. What happened in 2001 or 2002? We threw out the pay-as-you-go rules, and now we have a huge mess. Second thing, President Obama actually implemented this. I'll tell a short story on this. It makes me crazy. The idea is to have a commission, an independent commission, to recommend deficit reduction measures. These are things that are tough for politicians to say no. They don't like to say no, so have somebody outside come up with the ideas and then have the politicians just have to vote yes or no on the whole package so they can't pick it all apart. So it's an effective way, I think, to reduce the deficit. Got support in the House. We had the support to pass it in the House. The Senate had a bunch of co-sponsors. We got them to bring it up to a vote. We knew we had 60 votes for it based on all the co-sponsors and people said they were in favor of it. There were seven members of the Senate who were co-sponsors of the legislation. When it came up for a vote, voted no. So it failed. So they were out telling everybody that they were in favor of actually working on this stuff, and then when they actually had to vote, they voted the other way. It's disgusting behavior. It's ridiculous. So the president implemented a deficit reduction panel. Senator Simpson, former senator from Wyoming, Erskine Bowles, former chief of staff to the president, are working on this. They're leading this commission. It's not as strong as what we would have passed legislatively, but it's a step in the right direction. So pay as you go, the Deficit Reduction Commission, starting to move us in the right direction, talking about this stuff. I joined the Blue Dog Democratic Caucus. It's a group of Democratic congressmen whose focus is on fiscal responsibility, people who think we can't run a government with the kind of budget that we've built up in the last 10 years. And so we have rolled out a number of initiatives to give the power, more presidential power, to cut things out that come from Congress, to move us towards a balanced budget, to actually cut discretionary spending over the next couple of years to start to move us in the right direction. You heard the president say he's going to hold discretionary spending at zero. We came out saying that we should cut it 2% a year to get us moving even more in the right direction. So there's a whole bunch of initiatives that we as Blue Dogs are pushing for to be financially responsible and fiscally responsible, because it's untenable for us to have the long-term deficits that we have today. And as a small business person, as a family person who has balanced budgets and written payroll checks, and you just can't make this up. You've got to actually come up with it responsibly. And at the end of the day, everybody in this room is the ones that pay the bills. And we've got to be careful about what we spend it on, and we've got to balance the budget. It's just that simple.
Thank you.
Keep more here. Don't cut here. Cut somewhere else. That is part of the tricky part of this job, because all 435 members have the same idea. Let's balance it, but only in other people's districts, which is fine.
Cut it all equally.
Sorry?
Cut it all equally.
There you go. So let me just finish by saying this. It is a great honor to represent people in the 20th District. I am so impressed with having 100 people show up at meetings. I do a couple of these a day, many days, and people show up and they get engaged and they debate and people disagree, but they talk about issues. And this is what makes America great, is people being involved in their government, knowing what's going on, and staying informed and staying active. And I really appreciate everybody being here, and I thank you so much for your time and energy, and I thank you so much for letting me represent you.
Thank you.